All right. Well, let's go ahead and get started. I feel like I'm loud. Am I louder than? I know. I can feel like my brain is vibrating every time I. Well, I'll keep vibrating for the people at home. Yeah. Okay. Good. Someone's doing something. So good. All right. So we're going to be looking at Joshua 10, and we're going to do our best to cover three chapters tonight. My goal is to conquer the entire land of Canaan tonight, so should be pretty easy to do in 45 minutes. So that's what we're shooting for. Aim high. Chapters 9 and 10, however, go together really well, and since it's been a couple of weeks, I thought we would just review very quickly what happened in chapter 9. So looking at kind of the first two verses of chapter 9, Joshua and Israel just got through destroying and conquering the city of Ai, and before that, Jericho. And so now the Gibeonites saying, "We're next door." To where they are currently. Excuse me. So we need to think of something to do. So they convince Joshua and Israel that they have come from a very far distance, and they learned about what they did to Jericho, and we want to make a covenant of peace with you. And basically, they do that through flattery, and they take the bait, and they accept terms of peace. Then 3 days later, they find out, wait a second, you're so very far, as in 7 miles away. And so why did you trick us? Well, it's because we've heard about you, and you were going to destroy us. Notice the first two verses of chapter 9. When all of the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country, lowland, coast of the Great Sea, toward Lebanon, the Hittite, Amorite, Canaanite, Perizzite, Hivite, and the Jebusite heard of it. They formed kind of a massive army. And so these are kind of the kings of the southern part of Canaan. And so they say, we need to band together in order to get rid of these Israelites who are just destroying everything in their path. So they do that, and kind of 3 through 27 is kind of a parenthesis on what the Gibeonites did to Israel. So they made a covenant with them. Chapter 10 basically picks up right off where we left in chapter 9, verse 1 and 2. Does that make sense? It took me a long time to say that, but that's kind of what we're dealing with. I see verses 3 through 27 of chapter 9 kind of going on while these kings are kind of coming together and planning their attack. So while they're doing that, the Gibeonites trick the Israelites into making peace with them. Looking at chapter 10, we're going to try to cover three chapters, 10 through 12, and we're going to spend the majority of our time in chapters 10 and 11. So if we have about 2 to 3 minutes left for chapter 12, that's okay, because that's kind of what I'm shooting for. So don't get panicked about our time. So chapter 10, looking at verses 1 through 5, you have Adonizedek, who is king of Jerusalem, assembles the kings to fight Israel. Jerusalem is about 5 miles south of Gibeon. Okay, so they are really close to Jerusalem, so it makes sense for this king to say, okay, we need to do this quick, because Jerusalem's next. If I don't do something quick, I'm going to be destroyed, is kind of what he's thinking. He knows what Israel did to Jericho and Ai, leaving no survivors, including the king of both of those cities. So he feared Gibeon because it was a mighty city and he needed help defeating it. So you have this king of Jerusalem assembling these five kings, and they're attacking Gibeon, the city that just made peace with Israel. So what do you think's in Adonizedek's mind? Why is he attacking Gibeon? What are your thoughts? Yes, sir.
He doesn't want anybody else joining forces with the enemy.
Okay, good. So I think you're exactly right. So you have the idea of the Gibeonites, they were supposed to be our allies, right? They were supposed to be joining us to fight Israel, and now they've joined our enemy. And so this is going to be a lesson for anyone else. If you decide to join Israel, this is what we're going to do to you. So this is kind of a lesson for Gibeon, yes, but also a lesson for everyone else, not to do what Gibeon did. So he doesn't feel, it seems to me, how I read this, is he does not feel at least comfortable enough on his own to attack Gibeon. So he enlists the help of these four other kings to help him fight Gibeon, which was a pretty good-sized city. All five kings gather together with their armies, and they fight against the city of Gibeon. Five kings, verse 1, they should be able to attack this city, destroy it, and give them a lesson and everyone else a lesson. Any thoughts or comments of kind of the mindset of these five kings in verses 1 through 5? Okay, yes.
He might have been afraid because if Gibeon, as big as it is, decided they needed to make peace with Israel, then I surely did.
So say that again.
Then I surely did. He may have decided, well, if Gibeon, as big as that city is, decided they had to make peace with Israel, then
I got you. I got you. So, yeah, okay. So if they needed to do it, then little me, yeah, good.
Men of warriors.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So we're learning more about the Gibeonites in chapter 10 than we did in chapter 9. But we have kind of all these cities: Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon. And all of these cities would be basically south. Think south of Jerusalem. Gibeon would be kind of near the top, Gilgal, and all these would be kind of southern Judah cities. Here, brainers. Okay, so looking at verses 6 through 14, Gibeon sends a message to Joshua we need your help. So they see all these kings, this massive army, and so he's able to send a message to Joshua. We are up against the five kings of the Amorites. Please come quickly, is kind of the idea, right? So if you're Joshua, what would you be tempted to do after receiving this message, given on what they just did to him? Yeah, I mean, that's what you're supposed to do with the covenant, right? As soon as you make it, you break it. That's kind of the idea when we read the New Testament and how covenants were thought of. This is what you get, right? This is just penalty for trying to trick us, and now you got what's coming to you. But how does Joshua respond? Okay, yeah, Joshua does the right thing by agreeing to help them because of their covenant. And so Joshua is going to stay true to his word. And since we've made a covenant with you, then we're obligated to protect you. Yes, ma'am. Yes, there in verse 8. Yeah, and I think, go ahead.
Just really cool because they like royally mess up in chapter 9 by not asking God about right. this and getting tricked. And yet God is still merciful to them. Like, I know what I should be doing here is, you know what, you're on your own. You messed up. Deal with the consequences. But he's like, I'm still going to show my power even through your sin, which is kind of amazing.
It is. Good. Yeah, excellent point. God of second chances. And I think they tried to make things right at the end of chapter 9. And so now God is with them again. And the idea of he has forgiven them, it's as though he's forgotten it and he's moving on. And now he's going to be with them. So you have there verse 7, Joshua, okay, we'll come help. And then God tells them seemingly what he always does in this book. Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you. So it's kind of what we read about in chapter 1, right? Do not fear. Be strong and courageous. I am with you. Be sure to do exactly as I say. Not one of them shall stand before you. That all of those things are kind of repeated at the beginning. But why do you think God repeated it if he already told it to him in chapter 1? Do we ever need reminded?
I think just to remind
him. Absolutely.
It's the biggest army that we've faced so far.
Exactly. Yes, absolutely. If you got, five kings, all from southern part of Judah, but would become Judah. This is a massive, massive army. And it reminds you of 2 Peter, right? I say these things as a reminder, even though you already know them. Being reminded is really helpful. And so God tells them, I'm with you. Don't fear, even though they are like the sand of the seashore. I got this. And he's going to prove that to him. So verses 9 through 11, Joshua and Israel attack, and the kings and the armies flee before them. So it says they marched all night from Gilgal to Gibeon. Now the map that I used, it says it's about 17 to 20 miles hike. So you're walking all night,
uphill,
in the dark, and then let's go ahead and fight when we get there. So this is obviously the Lord helping them with them. Notice it says, verse 10, the Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon. So the emphasis is on what the Lord is doing, right? This is the Lord confounding, confusing, and slaying them. And what else kind of tells you this is God at work and not Israel in this section?
Verse 11.
The New American Standard says, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them, kind of in hailstones, but you just get the picture. God's in heaven and he's just throwing these balls at them, these stones. And what happens because of that?
More.
So if you're Israel, what is God showing you? What is God proving to you? Absolutely. I'm fighting for you. What else do you think? What would that show?
It's not
by your own strength that this is occurring.
Absolutely. You should not take credit for winning this victory, because I'm up in heaven throwing large stones at these people, killing more than you are with the sword.
And not hitting you.
Yes.
Which I think is really cool.
I agree. It reminded me of Egypt and how some of the plagues only affected the Egyptians, and yet Goshen was right by Egypt, and it didn't affect them at all. So I think we see kind of a parallel in that, but God is very good at aiming from heaven. Yes, sir.
From then on, he repeats so often, do not fear. And to see God do this,
yeah.
He says, I don't know how he's going to whip the next bunch,
right.
But I can't wait to see.
Yeah.
It really does build them up to the point where they think, God's on our side. There's nobody going to stand in front of us.
Yes. And I think the contrast would be, man, look at us. Look what we were able to do. Look how great and powerful we are. No, this is God. And to Allison's point, it's verse 11, as they fled before Israel. So Israel is on the attack, right? They're running away, and yet God is nailing them with these stones. And Israel seems to be close proximity to them. So that's just a powerful showing of you better be on God's side. And that's pretty powerful, pretty amazing. So God is faithful. He does exactly what he says he was going to do. It's an obvious way for God to show Israel and their enemies that he is the one fighting for them. It's not them.
You know, there's so many things to consider here. The Israelites are in territory they've never been in.
Right. Good point.
They're marching at night. Who's guiding them, you suppose? The Lord, of course.
Right.
So he's providing light.
Yes.
Guidance for them. It's just unreal how God cared for them all the way through, because there's no way they could have done these things not knowing the territory or the terrain or anything. And
then
fight.
Yes. If you go back to chapter 9, verse 1, it describes where each of these kings were from. So you had the hill country, the lowlands, the coast, all these different terrains that they would be very familiar with, but not Judah, or Israel, excuse me. And I think that just magnifies your point. Which is a really good one. Any other thoughts through verse 11?
Two of the cities the giants were from too, because there were giants both in heaven and in what's going to be Jerusalem. And this weakens their armies. When they come up against those cities,
right.
I mean, they sent their best out. They didn't come home.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And remember what Moses told them in Deuteronomy. You're going to be fighting armies and nations that are bigger and stronger than you are. Yet I'll be with you, and I'll take care of it. So this is going to be really helpful for them going forward. We're going to learn that it took a little while for them to kind of do the first wave through Canaan and defeating everyone. But I think this battle in particular, this massive army, and yet God is just knocking them out. He's confounding them. He's slaying them. It's okay. We can trust the Lord. It doesn't matter how big the army is. God's going to take care of us. So again, it doesn't matter how big our problem is, right? God can take care of it. Are we going to trust in the Lord, or are we going to try to trust in our own might, or what have you? Yes, sir.
And then you look at the New Testament, and you say, why is this story important for us? Because when it says that we're against principalities and powers in the air, but nobody is going to stop the kingdom of God.
Right.
That you might think the church totally disappeared sometime in history. not so.
Right. Yeah. Look at 12 through 14. What amazes you in those three verses? There's several things that amaze me, but what?
Standing still.
Okay. So the fact that God made the sun and the moon just kind of stay still for almost 24-hour period or a day's period.
Time stopped.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. What else do you find amazing?
But Joshua asks.
Absolutely. And that hit me. What do my prayer requests look like? Ephesians 3, right, 20 and 21, I believe, God will do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think. I think this is an enormous amount of faith in Joshua and say, God, I don't think you've ever done this before, but could you make the sun stop? Because we could really use some more daylight to get rid of this army. And God says, yeah, I can do that. Powerful.
It's kind of neat that he's not wishy-washy about it either. He's like, God, could you maybe, do you think?
Right.
If it's your will, God, like, we kind of have to qualify sometimes.
Yes.
He's like, son, stand. Because he's had, look at what he's just seen with his own eyes.
I've always thought, what did the people think on the other side of the world when the sun didn't come up?
Yeah.
And I think about, there were already people populated, like the Aztecs and all those, and the sun doesn't come up. I tell you, I would have been pretty freaked out.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of things we don't know about that. Could God have made it where the sun still shone regularly? I'm sure. So there's just a lot of things we don't know about that. But it is pretty powerful of what God or Joshua asked for, and of course, God doing. And so God was, again, if you're an Israelite, what does this show you? What does this prove? How does this help you going forward? God is able to kill people with stones from heaven. He's able to make an entire army flee from a much lesser, smaller army. And he's able to even keep the sun still. When we're with God, we're good, right? What can man do to me when we have the Lord? So these are just some really powerful, helpful stories for them, but also for us. And it shows you how important it is and how powerful it is to be on the Lord's side and to make sure you're with him. Yes, ma'am.
I'm pretty sure I read this. The time in Isaiah when Hezekiah asked for the sun to go backwards.
Yes.
Balances out the rest of the state. Is that right?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah, I can see that.
Somebody actually did some research and decided there was 24 hours missing.
I've heard all that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I throw it to, they're just trying to be smart and figure all this out. So I don't know. I don't know. That could be the case. I'm not one to comment much on that. All right. So look at 12 to, we covered 12 to 14, right? All right. Sorry, felt like I was rude to you, Miss Julie. I didn't mean to be.
Not to be so worried about what disturbs the general population about.
Yeah,
you know, not being global warming or our government's going crazy and all that. God's in control.
Yeah, he's in control. And maybe there's some validity to the kind of the sundial going backwards, and I just don't know. So look at the fate of the five kings in verses 16 to 27. Joshua finds out that these kings are hiding in the cave of Makkedah, however you say that. And so Joshua says, okay, go ahead and put some large stones covering the mouth of that cave. So there's no way for them to get out. And then have some men there to, if they do try to escape, they'll have some men there to make sure they don't do that. But verse 19, you keep pursuing the enemy. Don't let this distract you from wiping out this massive army. So verses 20 and 21, Israel pursues the armies from the rear. And it seems to me how I read this, and you can help me with this. How I read it is they are attacking from the rear, and they're trying to kill as many people as they can before maybe those in front are able to get to the cities. And once they kind of get to the cities, then that's, you know, all they can do. So if they were to stay at the cave, then all those men still would have stayed alive. So Joshua still, you know, you keep pursuing them, try to knock them out, you have the reputation of Israel there in verse 21. Not one uttered a word against any of the sons of Israel. It just kind of shows the fear that they had because of God and Israel. And so then 22 to 27, Joshua kills the five kings. So he brings out the five kings, and instead of just killing them, what do you see Joshua doing in 24 and 25? And then the question, why does he do it?
Has all the people put their feet on their necks.
Okay, so yes. Yeah. So he gets all the people to kind of witness this. And then he gets kind of the chief army leaders. And they go over and they put their foot on the neck of these five kings. So I don't know how many army leaders there were, but I would guess probably more than five. So you have all these people put their feet on their necks. And so why does, and then Joshua says, don't fear, be strong and courageous. God is with you, and you will do the same thing to all your enemies that you fight. So why do you think Joshua is making a big theatrical event of this? Any thoughts? Yes, ma'am.
They still have a lot to conquer. There are still a lot of difficult places to conquer. So that's one thing to encourage them.
Well, it's worth getting around.
Yeah.
All these other kings that they hadn't found yet would hear about it. That's very likely.
Sure. Yeah, and to Julie's point, they still have the entire northern part, and really kind of the central part, central and northern part of Palestine or Canaan to still wipe out. Yes?
Yeah, just getting them to think about how, you know, much their blood was pumping and how scared they probably were when they first saw that giant army with five cities.
Right.
You know, and then now it's like, remember the top dogs from all those cities?
Yep.
They're nothing to you now. Like, look at what you can do when God's on your side.
Exactly. Yes. I think the lesson, if God, or go ahead.
Well, I'll let you see what the lesson is. But I was just going to think that the lesson here is that they're always at a disadvantage except that the Lord's on their side.
Right. Yeah, they're always going to be outnumbered. Yeah,
they're always going to up against superior.
Right.
Horses,
yes.
Giants, all this other kind of stuff that they were afraid of 40 years ago.
Right.
But now, God's on their side.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Why a foot on the neck? I think he just gets regular people from the children of Israel. They might have been a leader of the army or something.
Well, it does say that.
But why they put the foot on the neck is to say, who is a king compared to God? They just learned, who is a pharaoh compared to God? And I think the lesson there, it extends on to Saul. When they want a king, kings are nothing. God is everything.
Good. So these would have been some of the most, or the most powerful men of South Palestine. And here we have, now they're getting stepped on. Good. So if God can defeat these five kings, he can. You don't need to worry about anything else, right? So God is really, and I think that's why We're spending so much time in chapter 10 dealing with these five kings, but he's going to go in super speed, starting in chapter 11 and especially 12, and just saying, okay, and then God wiped them out. So he's kind of proving himself here, and I think proving himself to the Israel, you can trust me, and I'm more powerful than these kings that you're going up against. So a very good lesson for all of us. So Joshua hangs them on five trees, buries them in the cave that they tried to hide in for their safety. Since you liked it there so much, you can stay there. So verses 28 to 43, we'll just do 28 to 39. And you kind of go through there, and a lot of repetition, right, that you see in those verses. How many cities did God conquer there? All of them. Okay. Okay. Yes, I'll give you half credit. What's a good biblical number?
Seven.
Yeah. So he conquers seven cities there. It's kind of a complete number. And you have the phrase, no survivor, utterly destroyed, just as he did to Jericho and the first two. And then they kind of build on one another. God defeated Lachish just like he did to Libna, and kind of go back in that way. Hebron, Hebron, looking at 36 and 37, that is more of a region. Because notice verse 37, they captured it and struck it, its king, and all its cities. And so we have some cities, and Hebron may be kind of a region with many cities in it. But you just have God just wiping them out. And then 40 to 43 is kind of the summary of the southern part of Israel. That God, the parts of the land Joshua conquered, verse 40, is able to win in the hill country, the Negev, the lowland, the slopes. God utterly destroyed everyone, including their kings. And you see verse 41 is the boundaries. Verse 42, Joshua conquered all of this land because God fought for Israel. And then they return to Gilgal, and that's kind of their home base, if you will. Return to Gilgal, and we're going to go north next. And so that's kind of chapter 11, and then 12 is a summary of the entire thing. But any thoughts through chapter 10? Yes, ma'am. Okay, good. So it may kind of emphasize the idea of seven, to include, just have seven cities listed, including them all. Because I think they're in chapter 12, I think there's 16 cities that are conquered, and then 15 in the north. So we'll jump ahead there. All right, so look at chapter 11. And we'll go ahead and conquer the north of Canaan real quick. Verses 1 through 5, you have Jabin, king of Hazor, forms an alliance with other kings to get rid of Israel. So again, you have all these different regions, the Canaanite on the east and the west, the Amorite, Hittite, Perizzite, Jebusite, Hivite, and they form this massive army. And so I would say, just because it seems like the text is emphasizing how massive this army is, looking there, verse 4, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots, which would have been kind of the powerhouse military weapons of the day. So they came and encamped at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. And what do you see? God's speech there in verse 6. I thought we'd read that. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them, For tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. What is amazing to you about that, what God says?
You're going to have to do that.
I'm going to do it. Yeah. And this massive army with all the horses and the chariots, don't worry about them. And he says that for this time tomorrow, I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. So this is a huge victory. And so it just powerful, amazing promise by God. But he's proven himself, right, able to conquer the enemies through the previous victories. Interesting, he says, you shall hamstring. Is there any other version there instead of hamstring? The idea of crippling their horses.
Cut the legs off is what it means.
Cut the legs off. Okay. So I think it's kind of to break their legs to where they're unable to run or trot or things of that nature. Interesting. Why do you think he would want them to injure their horses to the point where they're not going to be any good for battle, and then burning the chariots? Why do you think God would have them do that?
You don't need them.
You don't need them. I think that's the idea. Instead of acquiring chariots and horses, What is a tendency then? Well, I'm going to put my trust in horses and chariots. And the psalmist, a few times, Psalm 20, verse 7, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord, our God. Psalm 33, 17, the war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might it cannot rescue. So again, that's Psalm 20, verse 7, and Psalm 33, 17. Just kind of gives you an idea of, don't put your trust in horses, chariots, things of that nature. Trust in the Lord. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, that's just saying that don't pay any attention to numbers,
right,
to technology, to superior forces. All that makes no difference against the Lord.
Right. And it's interesting, in Deuteronomy, what was one of the things that God told the kings not to do? Remember?
Accumulate horses.
Yeah, don't accumulate horses for yourself. Just trust in me. So maybe that's the idea of kind of hamstringing, crippling the horses, and burning the chariots. Verse 7, Joshua and his army attack. And again, you kind of put yourself, it's easy to just read over this. But you're an Israelite soldier. They're all taller, stronger, bigger than you are. They're a massive number. You can't even count them all. Like, okay, I want you to attack. You first, right? Well, they attack. And they go on the offensive. Would have taken a lot of faith. Probably the largest army, even bigger than the army in chapter 10. But notice verse 9. Joshua obeys the Lord, and does things that, humanly speaking, human wisdom does not make sense. Why would you cripple horses, and why would you burn chariots? But they do it, and so they do what God says, even though maybe to them it did not make much sense. So that's good. Good that they did that. All right, I'm running out of time. So I may keep going, if that's okay. Joshua destroys the cities, verses 10 to 15. He destroys the city of Hazor. So he killed the king of Hazor, which for that would have been Jabin, kind of the leader of this outfit. And Joshua struck everyone with the sword and burned the city with fire. I heard someone say that Hazor would have probably been the largest city in kind of northern Palestine. It would have been a really big city, one of the bigger cities of that time. And it's pretty unusual for Joshua to burn the city. What other two cities were burned? Do you remember so far?
Jericho and Ai,
yeah. So, and this would be the third one that's mentioned that they burned the city. Most of the time, what would happen? Yeah, they get the spoil, including the entire city. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 10, it says God was going to give them cities that you did not have to build. And so this is kind of a gift to you, but they decided to burn this one as well. So Joshua captured all the cities, killed their kings as Moses commanded them, and Israel takes all the spoil, and Joshua is faithful. Verse 15 seems to emphasize that. Joshua is faithful in doing all that God commanded Moses, and that's what's going to give them success if they obey what the Lord told them to do. Thoughts or comments through verse 15? All right, so 16 to 20, summary of the territory. Joshua conquered, Joshua took the land, captured all the kings, putting them to death. Verse 18, it kind of a note there, Joshua fought for a long time against these kings, and they learned their lesson. No longer did they make peace with any of them, except for the Gibeonites that we read about, chapter, I think, 9. So the Lord hardened the king's hearts to wage war against Israel so that he could destroy them. So it kind of gives you an insight into what the other kings were thinking. If we gang up on them, if we have enough of us, we'll be able to get rid of them. And that speaks to what? It speaks to their arrogance, is what I was thinking. It speaks to their pride. Oh, we can take care of them. We're stronger. But God uses that against them. And verse 21 to 23, Joshua cuts off the Anakim, or the giants, from the land. And where do the Anakim remain? Yes, so the three of the cities of the Philistines. Yes, yeah, so you have Gaza, Gath, Ashdod, Goliath comes from Gath, right? And Philistines would become kind of the primary enemy during kind of the latter part of Judges, Saul and David constantly fighting the Philistines. But verse 23 provides rest from the war. It gives me about 30 seconds to cover chapter 12, which may be more than enough. So chapter 12 is just basically a list of the kings that are defeated, that God defeated. Verse 1, these are the kings defeated on the east of the Jordan. So verses 1 through 6, this is what God did with Moses. And you see the contrast. This is what Moses did. Moses delivered. And then starting in verse 7, Joshua delivered. So Moses conquered the east side of the Jordan, Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh. And then Joshua did the left or the west, whichever you prefer, side of the Jordan. They conquered a lot of land, conquered a lot of different kinds of land. That's kind of noted in this, and defeated a lot of different people and nations. And kind of that's emphasized in these. 31 cities Joshua defeated, 9 to 24. I think it's 16 in the south and 15 in the north, so pretty kind of equal there. But all of this, what is chapter 12? What do you get most out of chapter 12? And kind of summarizing all this up, what's the main point? You can't defeat God. Yeah, if you're on God's team, you win. So a small nation coming from the wilderness was able to defeat and conquer the entire land. Now, don't think that they annihilated everybody. They killed absolutely everyone. That's going to be kind of left to the tribes to do. All right, Manasseh, you get this territory. Michael's going to do all that for us next week. So then it would be up to that nation or that tribe to get rid of the rest of the people, which some do well and some are terrible at doing, as we'll read in Judges chapter 1. So thank you for your good participation in rushing through that. All right, thank you. And what, we get 13 to 21? I think I'm giving you about 8 or 9 chapters to cover. You're welcome.